Chapter 21. After much, too much debate, UNEF Command did something that shocked me. Wait, are you sitting down? You'd better sit down before you hear this. Also, if you are operating heavy machinery, please stop. Ready? Whew. I need to take a breath before I say this. Okay. UNEF Command made a smart decision. I know. I couldn't believe it either. Somehow, the squabbling politicians from 12 rival nations came to their senses and made a sensible, if obvious, decision. A series of decisions, actually. In the official announcement, the policy closely followed the recommendations of the UNEF Joint Chiefs, the senior military leaders of the component nations. Even more surprising, the vote was unanimous, 12-0. Skippy Stan abstained from voting, of course. The policy had two, really three, elements. First, diplomacy. We needed allies, so Ambassador-at-Large Chotek was directed to approach the Jirapha to open negotiations. We wanted warships. Lots of warships. Earth's industrial base had no capability to construct starships of our own, so we needed existing ships that could be upgraded. Jirapha ships were sufficiently advanced that they could be upgraded to our standards without having to completely tear the ships apart. What we wanted from the Jirapha were warships and star carriers. Also fleet support ships that could build replacement parts for damaged ships. What would they get in return? Our everlasting gratitude and affection. Plus, maybe a nice Hallmark card and a fruit basket. Also, to be more practical, we were offering technology. The Jirapha would be able to upgrade their own ships with Maxalk's level technology. In some cases, the tech we planned to offer was a slightly dumbed-down version of the systems aboard Valkyrie. Withholding some technology was an insurance policy to maintain our edge. Once the technical knowledge was transferred to the Jirapha, it was inevitable that other hostile species would acquire it. Every species in the galaxy sought to climb another rung on the technology ladder by stealing or capturing advanced technology equipment, then copying or reverse-engineering the alien systems. It was also inevitable that some of our technical info would be available for purchase. We couldn't completely stop it, so we had to plan for the future. There were also cases where certain technologies would not be transferred to the Jirapha simply because they could not yet make use of them. Either the base structure of their starships could not handle the tech, or they lacked the ability to manufacture the required components. What mattered was that the Beatles would make a significant leap in capability, and both the Maxalks and Rindaloo would see their long-held edge degrade. We expected to get pushback from the senior species, but screw them. Chotek was also directed to open negotiations with the Ruhar. We were anxious to settle the status of humans on Paradise. Would our people be allowed to remain there, and if so, could Paradise be used as a forward staging base for future Alien Legion initiatives? Personally, I thought we should demilitarize our presence on Paradise to avoid making that planet a target. Attacks there could only make the local Ruhar population, and the Ruhar public overall, view humans as trouble. Now that we had Elder weapons, humans were no longer seen as the scrappy underdogs who had gained the respect and affection of the average hamster. According to Perkins, when she left Paradise, the humans there were already viewed with suspicion, despite our repeated assurances that the humans on Paradise had not known anything about the Merry Band of Pirates. The Ruhar federal government had also expressed a healthy skepticism that the Legion concept should continue. Really, it made no sense for humans to serve under Ruhar leadership. Any future Legion actions would be joint operations with the hamsters under our terms. We also wanted starships from the Ruhar. Not warships. Their ships would be useless to us in a fight, even if we upgraded them. No, what we wanted from the Ruhar were transport ships, both civilian passenger liners and assault transports. But that was all stuff for Chotek to deal with. So, diplomacy was first. We would start with the Beatles and hamsters, then expand our alliances if that made sense. The second element in the policy announced by UNEF Command was a major push to establish a secure human presence off-world. This time, we would not only be sending scientists to Avalon, we would be sending people, thousands of people. The fact that Avalon had zero capacity to house and feed thousands of colonists was not an issue. The ships going there would be jam-packed with supplies. Enough shelf-stable food to support the colony for 5 years until they could adapt the biosphere to grow enough of their own food. I'm sure plenty of the scientists I pulled off Avalon would be pissed at me for interrupting the very important experiments there. If they wanted to yell at me, all I could say is they could get in line. The decision to move forward with colonizing a beta site was a pleasant surprise, but UNEF Command followed that with another surprise. They wanted to set up a forward operating base at Club Skippy, despite Skippy's warning that the next wormhole shift would expose that lonely world to easy access by hostile aliens. The Joint Chiefs understood that risk. They felt Club Skippy could be a temporary first step, a secure facility to conduct training and act as an off-world supply dump. Also, UNEF planned to establish not quite a colony there, but a military base for the Alien Legion. At first, 40,000 ground troops would be stationed at Club Skippy to train and be ready for future Legion operations, whatever those were. That is 40,000 soldiers and Marines, plus pilots and crews to operate the new fleet of starships we hope to buy from the Jarraptha. The colony at Avalon is why we wanted to acquire passenger liners from the Ruhar. The assault transports would be for the Legion. Okay, so, decisions had been made by the civilian leadership. That meant I was going to be busy. The first thing I did was call Sims. "You hurt?" I asked. "Yes." She didn't say whether she had been informed by Skippy directly. It didn't matter. The UNEF announcement was all over every form of media on the planet. "What do you think?" "It's a pretty bold move to..." "Sir," she sighed. "Why don't you just skip the pleasantries and get to the point? You want to know what I decided?" "Okay, I want to know what you and Frank decided," I said, to let her know that I understood she had to consider the effect on her husband. There was a pause and some whispering in the background. She said something like, "Yes, I'll tell him." Then she spoke to me again. "The answer is yes, we're going. But it's not what you think. Frank is going to Avalon. Just for the first year, to finish the assessment project. I will be setting up logistics to support Club Skippy." "That fast?" I held the phone away from my face and stared at it. When did..." "The Pentagon gave me a heads up about the announcement last night. Frank and I talked, and we're ready." "Oh, that's great." Shit, why was I the last person to know? Skippy had some splaining to do after I got off the call. "We should..." "Sir, I have to go. Frank wants to talk with you." She handed off her phone. "Joe," he said. "Hey, Frank. Congrats, I guess." "On what?" "Going to Avalon. The science opportunity." I cringed, smacking myself in the forehead with one hand. Maybe if I thought really hard about it, I could make the conversation even more awkward. "The science is what I want to talk about," he explained. "I don't think UNEF has any idea how difficult it will be to set up a colony there." "Well, they're supposed to be bringing enough supplies for 5 years," I reminded him, suspecting he already knew that and that supplies were not the problem he was worried about. "Joe, to successfully grow crops there and support domestic animals, we need to set up an entire sustainable biosphere. The fungus problem on Avalon caught us by surprise. We need to find a solution. We barely understand how Earth's biosphere functions."
Sure, but people have been growing food on Paradise for years now. We grew food on Gingerbread. That's the planet in the Roach Motel."
"Yes," he said in his "I am being very patient explaining science to you" voice. "Those planets had mature biospheres already. Paradise's biosphere had a long time for native life plus organisms introduced by Kristang and Ruhar to adjust to coexist with each other. The Ruhar still had significant problems in making the planet practical for widespread agriculture, and they have extensive experience with bioengineering organisms to new environments. Earth organisms were just another adjustment, and you know how difficult it was to establish agriculture there." He was right about that. When I was a newly promoted colonel with the call sign Planter, my job had been to oversee our initial efforts to convert abandoned Ruhar farmland to growing earth crops. We had discovered through painful trial and error that it was easier and far more productive to plant our crops in new fields to avoid harmful contamination from the aggressive microbes that Ruhar farmers put into the soil of their fields.
When I was given the assignment, I expected the most vital of our supplies would be the seeds and tubers and whatever else plants grew from. I was wrong. In most cases, we had to churn soil conditioner in the ground first to support a healthy root system and help our plants extract nutrients from the alien soil. The Ruha knew that soil conditioner imported from Earth was the key to humans becoming self-sufficient on Paradise. That is why their guerrilla actions focused on destroying our limited stockpile of that vital material. That was all ancient history now. Or so I thought. Yeah, I know, I told Frank. We have to prepare the soil and pollinate crops by hand until we can bring in flying insects like bees. And we have to... That is just scratching the surface of the problem. New types of fungus spores brought to Avalon on the shoes of a colonist could grow out of control and wipe out an entire season of crops. That's what we think caused the problem the first time. Introduced organisms that are alien to the native life there could disrupt and poison the entire biosphere, so it becomes unable to sustain any complex life forms. If you think I'm being an alarmist about this, I don't. Skippy told me about worlds that were captured and the invading species tried to bioform the ecosystem for themselves, but it was a disaster. Then you know the risk. Can you talk to UNEF Command? Explain, Frank, I could, but they won't listen to me, not about this subject. But you can talk to Skippy. UNEF will listen to him. Talk to Skippy? He said in a tone like I had suggested he go on a strict diet of tofu and vegetables. I just recently got him to stop talking to me all the time. How did you do that? I said too quickly. I'd better not tell you. Joe, Colonel Bishop, he added. Please let UNEF know that you are concerned about this, and I will talk to Skippy. We probably can create a successful colony on Avalon. My concern is we're going too fast. We need to move fast, before the aliens out there interfere. I tried to keep a civilian's don't-get-it tone out of my voice. I understand that. Microorganisms don't care about the politics of intelligent beings. They have their own schedule. I will do what I can, but the first wave will consist of at least 4,000 people. The plan calls for them to be scattered around the planet to lessen the impact of droughts and other natural disasters. It's not natural disasters that should worry UNEF. It's disasters we will cause by moving too fast. All right, he sighed. At least on Avalon, I won't have to worry about our safety whenever I see lights in the night sky. He paused. Maybe he expected me to say something. Joe, I don't have to worry about that, do I? No, Avalon is safe. So is Club Skippy. As far as Skippy knows, no one else can get to either place, and Skippy is the expert. Okay. This, Joe. This was a good idea. What? Setting up a beta site. A safe haven. Oh. Thanks. I accepted the praise without reminding him that I created the concept of a beta site because I feared the Merry Band of Pirates would ultimately fail to protect our homeworld. Feared that I would fail, that my reckless failure to think more than one step ahead would doom all of our efforts. Now that we had elder weapons, it was easy to forget the panicked sense of desperation I had felt back then. Forgetting that could be fatal. I mean that. We are damned lucky that you were in command of the pirates. Gee, thanks. That's not just me talking, he added. That's what Jen says. Do you know how much she admires you? Crap. How do I respond to that? Don't worry, Frank chuckled. He must have sensed how uncomfortable I was. She still thinks you should eat more vegetables. Frank, I laughed, relieved. Nobody can eat that many vegetables. Amen to that, brother, he muttered, and we had a bonding moment. Hey, someday you come to Avalon, and I'll grill a cheeseburger for you. That sounds great, I said honestly. Hey, sorry you two will be apart for so long. You just got married. Jen intends to join me there after Club Skippy gets up and running, unless you need her for some emergency. I will try not to, Joe. Don't make promises you can't keep. Jen is an army officer. She will go where she's needed. Then I will do what I can to ensure we don't have an emergency. We both knew I wouldn't have any control over that. Getting into Skippy's new man cave aboard Valkyrie only required me to duck only a bit. The hatch was sized for a Max Ulks wearing an environment suit to squeeze through it. Still, I had to be careful not to bash my head on the lip of the hatch. Hey, cool! I had practiced being enthusiastic while I walked through his man cave. It was not my best performance, but good enough. Wow, is that a genuine Elvis jumpsuit? Yes, it is. Though I expect you don't appreciate that. I snapped my fingers like I was searching my memory. Is that from his legendary Las Vegas residency? Why, yes. How did you... 1969, or was it 1970? It was 69, Joe. I did not know you were an Elvis fan. I wasn't, until I learned that you are. Figured I should at least check out his music. You liked it? He asked eagerly. Well, of course. He is the king of rock and roll, baby, I said in my awful Elvis impression. Oh, cool. Check it out, Joey, my boy. This shirt over here is one he wore in the movie Blue Hawaii. That is cool. Listen, I know that Brock got all this exceptional stuff for you. He did it on behalf of all humanity, Joe. Right. I can't afford anything like that, so I pulled a rectangular thing out of the bag I was carrying. I made this for you.
You made it? What is it?
Removing the covering, I showed him. A Skippy on velvet. I guess you can call it a Velpy. He gasped.
Magnificent is what I call it.
It was done on black velvet. The image was Skippy's shiny silver can wearing a gaudy gold crown with rays of lights shining out from him.
What are those rays, Joe? Is that light?
They are the glow of your awesomeness, of course.
Wow. I love it. Thank you. Quick, hang it up.
Elvis is the king of rock and roll. You are the king of awesomeness.
Gosh,
he choked up.
I don't know what to say.
You are very welcome. Thank you for sharing your awesomeness with us poor monkeys. We chatted for a while, which was good, because if I sucked up to him any more, I was going to hurl. Then I had to leave for a completely unnecessary meeting that I had scheduled as an excuse to get away from him. As I walked away, I flipped the middle finger toward the deck in the direction of Earth. To myself, I thought, suck it, Brock Steele. It was just going to be a short flight, not even transitioning through the local wormhole. Valkyrie would be remaining within 2 light-years of Earth on a shakedown cruise of 4 days, performing maneuvers to check out all the ship's systems that had been rebuilt and upgraded since we returned to Earth. If everything went well, the next time I took Valkyrie out would be to refuel the ship at Neptune, because we were close to running on reserves. The term shakedown cruise supposedly refers to pushing a ship to the limit to see if the vibration makes anything break. In this case, we would also be testing the new crew. If we did not discover a major flaw in either ship systems or personnel, Valkyrie would be going out again for a pre-deployment exercise, what the Navy calls a workup. Back when we only had the Flying Dutchman, conducting workups was a luxury we didn't have. Instead, we did on-the-job training, which is a nice way to say we were making shit up as we went along. This time, I was grateful for the opportunity to conduct a proper workup, partly because so many of the crew were new not only to the ship, but to serving aboard a real starship at all. They had been training aboard the Keyshawn and the Dagger, but those Kristang rust buckets were not proper warships, and the technology of Valkyrie was like high-order magic compared to the clumsy way that lizards made their ships fly. The good news was that when we conducted workups, one thing we would be testing is our procedures for workups. That was important because we planned to have many more than 2 starships. We intended to have a fleet. There were going to be a whole lot of ships, and they would need a lot of people to run them, and with people comes the need for procedures and other forms of bureaucracy. Listen, I hate bureaucracy and filling out stupid forms that have to go through 15 levels of approval before you get issued stuff like a carton of toothpaste, but the Army is not just a team, it is a big team, and somebody needs a way to keep track of stuff like toothpaste. If we can keep track of toothpaste, then we can track the important stuff like railgun darts. So I am totally okay with having written procedures for conducting workups. I just don't want to be the person who writes them. My new executive officer was a Japanese Navy captain named Nakamura. A Navy captain is the equivalent rank to an Army colonel, so I didn't outrank him, though I had more time in grade. Nakamura was a nice enough guy, I suppose. I just didn't know him well at all. UNEF had decided to rotate command candidates through the XO position aboard Valkyrie to give them experience before they hopefully got their own ships. That was a good and practical idea, and it meant I would be breaking in a new XO every couple of months. Hooray for me! My executive officer was not the only new face aboard the ship. Most of the crew was new to me. From the lead pilot couch, our new pilot Major Shepard turned to look at me, waiting for the order to jump. Maybe the expression on my face was reflecting my lack of comfort. None of our previous pilots were aboard Valkyrie. They had all moved on to other assignments. Reed had been promoted to Major and was conducting training at the UNEF Flight School in Pensacola. Chen was in Chengdu working to qualify pilots for Flying Panthers. After Armageddon, we had been thin on pilots, and adding Valkyrie had stretched our pilot roster nearly to the breaking point. That was one of the reasons why I learned to fly a Panther and took the basic course for Flying Valkyrie. Our pilots deserved a break when we returned to Earth, and training new people to fly our ships was vital in the long run. Still, when I looked at the pilot couches and saw two unfamiliar faces there, it made me uneasy. Knowing they had been through a compressed training course did not build my confidence, even though Reed and Chen vouched for all the new pilots we had aboard. Sure, we had Bilby and Skippy to prevent us from flying into a star. That was not the same as having full confidence that the new people truly understood what they were doing. It was unfair of me to question the qualifications of the new people. If Desai were with us, she would remind me that she had not known how to fly a Dodo dropship, then a Kristang frigate, then a Theranan star carrier. But she had not crashed us into anything. She also had said many times that while she considered herself a damned good pilot, the people who completed UNEF training and qualified for the Merry Band of Pirates were elite, the best of the best. Desai had no illusions that she could have qualified. She was our chief pilot because she earned her experience the hard way, and simply because I trusted her. Hearing her say that always reminded me that I would not have qualified to serve aboard the Flying Dutchman, so maybe I should trust the people who had put in the enormous effort required to qualify as a Merry Pirate. Anyway, it still made me nervous to have so many new people aboard the ship. I didn't know these people, and I was afraid of making a bad first impression by doing some doofus thing they would never forget. Pilot, I tried to project confidence. Jump coordinates confirmed? Confirmed, sir, Shepard said after a glance at his console. Looking at the console was for my benefit. He already knew the system was properly programmed. Maybe he sensed my discomfort. It's 106 light-years to Ursa Major. We have a full tank of gas, half a pack of chewing gum. It's dark. He looked at the main display that was showing a black starfield. Pulling a set of Ray-Bans from a pocket, he added, "And I'm wearing sunglasses." Right then, I knew we had a good pilot. Pointing to him, I ordered, "Hit it." We jumped. To the great surprise of pretty much everyone on Earth, Valkyrie led the way to Avalon less than 3 weeks later. The Flying Dutchman followed right behind, with three multi-mission modules bolted onto the Dutchman version 4.0's rather stumpy spine. Inside one of the modules were 882 people, including Frank Muller. How did we manage to jump away so quickly after UNEF announced the go-ahead to colonize Avalon? It's simple. They dusted off plans that had already been approved. Food and other supplies were stockpiled around the planet, and extensive work had been done to convert one of the multi-mission modules to carry human passengers. While I had been flying around the planet and going on vacation, Skippy was working to add attachment points to the Flying Dutchman so our former star carrier could transport three of those modules. The old Dutchman looked ridiculous with the modules hanging on its spine, and Nagatha reported the ship maneuvered like an overloaded oil tanker. But it could jump, and that's all we needed it to do. Hopefully, we soon would have real star carriers and passenger ships, and the Dutchman could... Well, it could do whatever UNEF assigned that ship to do. Truthfully, I was worried about the future of our trusty old ship. UNEF Command had asked Skippy about the possibility of cutting the ship apart to refit Jarrath the warships we hoped to acquire, and I told him to slow roll given an answer. While I understood the practical value of using resources in the most efficient manner, damn it, the Dutchman was special. Even though that ship had few original parts left from when we took it from the Theranon, it deserved better than to be used as a hangar queen. We also could not move Nagatha into a ship without tearing out the substrate embedded into the Dutchman's forward hull, and she wouldn't be the same. Damn, I don't want to think about it. What was I talking about? Oh yeah, how fast UNEF threw the mission together. Like I said, a lot of the prep work had been done before the Jarrath ships arrived, with over 20,000 people returning home from Paradise. Oddly, one element of preparation that I assumed would be the most difficult was actually the easiest: selecting colonists. Thinking about how to recruit colonists gave me a headache, but UNEF had already done that. They had a list of 50,000 volunteers who were approved for Avalon. All that was required was to confirm the applicants still wanted to go, replace people who dropped out with ones lower on the list, and prioritize the list to about 4,000 names. They needed to have useful skills, to get along well with others, and there were other requirements like being passably fluent in either English or Chinese. As a practical matter, the first wave of colonists needed to communicate with each other and... Okay, enough about the practical aspects of selecting colonists. Somebody else had done all the work. All I had to do was take Valkyrie out to escort the good old Dutchman. We followed the now familiar routine of waking up and going through the super-duty wormhole that connects the Milky Way to the Sculptor Dwarf Galaxy. While we didn't say anything to the crew, Skippy and I had a moment of anxiety waiting for the dormant wormhole to respond. He could not be absolutely certain that the wormhole network would not lock him out because of all the other shenanigans he had gotten into, like relocating wormholes to places they were not supposed to be. We both breathed a sigh of relief, or I did, and he emulated the experience, when the super-duty wormhole woke up and stabilized without a glitch. Ditto with going through the wormhole in Sculptor. It accepted the password immediately without comment, and I took Valkyrie through. The recon took a full day, which was enough time to determine there were no detectable threats in or near the star system. Avalon itself appeared to be okay. Native vegetation had overgrown the fields of experimental plants we left, and structures in the camp looked exactly as they were when we left. The entity at Maris was functioning properly as programmed by Skippy. The stealth field covering that world was gone, and the stretched-out gravity well had returned almost to normal. Skippy reported minimal effects on the orbits of other planets, and he expressed confidence that as a colony and safe haven, Avalon was good enough for monkeys. Anyway, blah blah blah, we dropped the supplies first, then landed the colonists. After endless irritating delays, we turned our ships around and headed home. The next trip to Avalon was not scheduled for 8 months, to give time for the people there to set up infrastructure that could eventually accommodate up to 50,000 more people. My mother would think Avalon was getting too crowded already. All the way home, I waited for disaster to strike. When we arrived at the far end of Backstop, the Dutchman waited in stealth a safe distance away while I took Valkyrie through to make sure it was safe for the vulnerable Dutchman to follow. Everything was fine. We jumped in near Earth, and I contacted UNEF Command while Skippy pinged the submine he had left behind. Everything was fine, as far as either of us could tell. UNEF Command congratulated my crew on a job well done and cleared us to escort the Dutchman home. We did that. Nothing bad happened. It was weird. Maybe I needed to get used to peacetime. Or maybe the universe was just waiting for the perfect moment to give me a beatdown.